How is modern day risk management like game theory? Why does one's confidence mellow over time? What role will interpretation play in the new investment landscape? Can you be too clever for your own good? Find out next. I'm Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Faces podcast, a podcast committed to revealing the richness and diversity of the world of investment by focusing on its people and their stories. I'm joined today by Colin Robertson, who is an independent advisor to two LGPS funds, London Borough of Tower Hamlets and London Borough of Harrow, within a portfolio career that he has had since 2013. He previously had the roles of Global Head of Asset Allocation for Mercury Asset Management on the asset management side and for Aon Hewitt on the consulting side, as well as having been a CIO in his time, and he has had extensive experience in working with a wide range of institutional clients. Welcome, Colin. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Ethel.
Well, let's start with your background and career journey. Can you talk us through where you're from, where you grew up, what you studied before entering the world of finance and investing?
Sure. So I was brought up in Glasgow, and I guess my first exposure to markets was when I was given shares in Glasgow Rangers Football Club as a rite of passage. And for whatever reason, I don't think I did much research. I sold them fairly soon after I got them. But that was my first exposure. And my family friends talked about shares, so it was part of my life, the stock market, even as a boy. So I went to school in Glasgow, and I studied languages and maths, and that led me to go to St Andrews University. And I guess one of the interesting things I did when I was there was actually during the summer holidays when I got a job in Zurich for Swiss Re as a kind of an actuarial research assistant, which was kind of an unusual thing to do. I worked for somebody who'd been the president of Society of Actuaries in the US. I sat in the French department where they all spoke French and did French things, but the language in the company was either German or Schweizerdeutsch. So it was a very international thing to do when I guess I was 19 or whatever. So that was the first exposure really to actuarial work, to financial markets, and to a career which is really pretty global altogether. So I was at St Andrews, and after St Andrews, I was lucky enough to get a scholarship to Berkeley in California, where I studied game theory under a chap called David Blackwell. And that was great. And he had various theorems named after him, which I thought was tremendous to study under somebody who was famous, and everybody else who was famous at Berkeley as well. So it was a fantastic place to study, and very global. Every gave all over the world to study there, to lecture there. And I remember actually that I had to take a use of English test because there's so many foreigners there, as it were. And myself and a Canadian chap, this thought was a bit unusual for us who were, you know, better English speakers than the Americans to be doing a use of English test, but we did it. And so that was that bit of it. I didn't really fancy life as an academic. It was a bit slow for me. So I came back to Scotland and I started work as a trainee actuary. And I did that on the liability side, which was doing surrender value calculations and things like that. I guess valuations of some sort. And there's about 1,000 of us on the liability side doing that. And there was these 8 people on the asset side, the fund management guys. And they got paid twice as much and had BMWs and went for tremendous lunches and seemed to have a great time. And it was really interesting stuff they did. So I managed to get traded across to the asset side. And that was the start of my investment career. I never looked back. I've always been in investment management or investing consulting ever since then.
Well, I'd love to just pick up on a few points there before we go into your investment perspective. So clearly, Berkeley, I'm not sure, was this what sort of time frame this was, the 70s, 80s, I presume 90s, somewhere in that time frame. Must have been a bit of a culture shock for somebody coming from Scotland, despite your having been ahead of an international career. So what was that like?
Yeah, it was fascinating from an analytical standpoint, but it was also really interesting culturally because you were all just different people from all around the world. It was very formative in that sense, and learning about, you know, learning about different cultures, living in a different country. In some ways, it was kind of like a gap year learning about different things. I don't think I'd ever really believe I was going to become a professor or maths or anything like that at all. So it was much more kind of a cultural, educational experience in broad terms. But it was a really good thing to do, and it certainly help form my character, I guess.
And as far as game theory, so that's always been a source of fascination for me. Yeah. How has that made you think? Do you think that you always sort of think with that lens now, having actually done a bit of a deep dive into it?
Yeah, it was interesting because it's actually kind of modern day risk management. It's exactly what you would need to do risk management, but it doesn't sound like it when you say it's game theory. It sounds like it's a degree in gambling, but it wasn't really. It was a probability theory, and it was really useful actually in later life in a deeply technical sense, which kind of is amazing because normally you go to university to learn how to analyze things, how to write essays or whatever else. You don't normally use in later life what you learned at university, but strangely, I have actually used what I learned in a technical sense. So that's good news, I guess.
And also, I presume it talks about incentives. We're talking a lot about moral hazard today. And I suppose incentives for good or bad behavior was probably a little bit of the psychology of how humans behave and the early strands of behavioral finance built into that.
Yeah, I mean, that's really important for investment. It's not just what you think is going to happen. It's what other people think is going to happen as well. So investment as allocation in particular is very much about having your own views and doing your own research and so forth. But it's about what other people think, and it's the difference between these two different viewpoints that's going to produce the profits for their performance. And so that is very important, psychology, behavioral science. I don't think my degree had an awful lot of that. It was very mathematical rather than being terribly psychological.
And now you were just about to touch on the beginning of your investment career. So you've worked on multi-strategy, but you've also cycled through the individual asset classes. Can you just touch on that?
Sure. I'm really lucky. I've done pretty much most of the jobs in investment management, which is great. You know, and my first job was half equities and half bonds, which is unusual. And then the sectors were done globally, even back then, which is the early 80s. So when I was an oil analyst, I covered US oil stocks, UK oil stocks, Canadian, European oil stocks. So that was a really good global start to life. And that was unusual back then. People didn't do that sort of thing back in the 80s. So I did that, and then I became a UK fund manager, then a US fund manager, and then I was head of international, and then I ended up as a chief investment officer. So that was the kind of the first stage really in my career. And then after that, after quite a number of years, I decided I really wanted to focus more on the macro, on economics and asset allocation strategy, and not do stock picking or be a CIO. I mean, chief investment officer is a great job. You do spend a lot of time on people management, marketing, management, et cetera, et cetera. So I was keen to have a fairly pure investment job, although I always did some other job as well. I think if you're go ahead of asset allocation, you are expected quite a few management jobs and not just do the strategy part of it. So I ran Japanese equities as a sideline at one stage and did other things like that. So it was a very wide job, but it was good to be really involved with the investments and not just doing marketing.
Now that you have cycled through those different asset classes, what would you say are your core investment beliefs? Any key cardinal rules that you hold dear?
Yeah, well, as I said, I think the key thing is the behavioral psychology part of it, and not just the having the right view. So that's important. I think in asset allocation in particular, you've got to be pretty clear as to what your time horizon is. So you have strategic asset allocation, which is kind of the actuarial modeling time frame, 10 years or whatever. And then you've got the very short-term hedge fund type time horizon. And then, I kind of developed a medium-term asset allocation, which is 1 or 2 year views, which I think is what most people in pension fund land would think is a tactical view. They're not really thinking of day by day or week by week changes in views. I mean, that may happen as part of a hedge fund investment, but the pension committee is not going to take a very short-term view. So I think there's 3 aspects. And so pension funds is very much strategic, and I would call it medium-term. So I think you've got to get your time horizons pretty well organized, otherwise you're going to get a bit of a mess. And I think part of it is also picking off the extremes, particularly in asset allocation. You do really get bubbles. So, one stage we had the Emperor's Palace in Japan working over the whole of California, and then we had the tech bubble with the tech stocks having pretty ludicrous valuations. So you got to know that at some stage that's going to collapse, although the danger is that it collapses after your career's ended by being too negative. But assuming you manage to avoid that, you can pick off these tops. The bottoms are tougher, I think, generally, because catching a falling knife is not an easy thing to do, or maybe not a very good thing to do. So, that's a very important aspect of it, is the timing aspect of it. I guess the other points I make are that it's not just about return, it's about risk. And I think you've got to make sure you look at a range of measures for risk. And people, I don't think, look at these things very deeply. So the most common measure, really, over the years has been volatility. And the people use what they say is 1 year volatility, but actually nobody actually uses that. What they do is they take monthly volatility and then annualize it. So it really is just monthly volatility to my mind. So that kind of thing, looking below the surface and seeing what the numbers really mean, is important. And then so you have that, and then the scenario testing is another form of risk measurement. And you know, that's fine as long as you think of the right scenarios. And strange, nobody really thought of the scenario of gilt yields going up ahead of the LDI crisis. So that didn't work too well. And then another one people now use, the fashionable one today, is VAR. And that's a 5% probability. What's the amount of money you're going to lose? But actually, people think it's 5% chance of losing X pounds. It's actually a 5% chance of losing at least X pounds, which could be 2X or 3X or whatever else. So that's kind of a misunderstood number as well. And the problem with VAR is it produces huge losses, which scares people off. It's not necessarily as risky as it sounds. So look at a whole range of measures, not just one measure. I guess the final comment would be on diversification, to make sure you do diversify. And again, this kind of, people don't do the maths very well for that. They look at correlations, and they tend to look at historical correlations. And that's just kind of nonsense, really, because the world changes, and you've got to look forward. But many people think it's too dangerous, too risky to look forwards. But you've got to look forwards. You're just pretending that you're doing the numbers. You're not really doing proper numbers unless you look to the future. So that's another aspect of it. So I think the message there is you've got to look below the surface, not take the easy route. Do something in depth. Think about what you're actually doing in each of these areas.
And if, in terms of risk, because this is so key, particularly today, so is that how you recommend the sort of a triangulation between different metrics and ultimately you know, deciding on the factors that are key to a client's own risk appetite?
And the answer is yes, but as an independent advisor, I'm really kind of looking at other people's work and sort of giving a bit of guidance as to what else they might do. I'm not really doing things from scratch as an independent advisor. Back in the day when I was a CIO or whatever, then it was different. But now it's very much looking at what investment consultants are producing or actuaries are producing and sort of saying, well, shouldn't you look at this angle as well? Or have you really thought this through properly? I'm an advisor now, and that's a different job from being a fund manager.
As an advisor, just to jump to that question, what do you think is key in what making a good advisor, a good investment committee member? Is it on this challenge point? Is it the kind of guidance point? How do you think, and stepping back, obviously, because one is not in the officer role, what do you think makes a good person in a similar position?
Okay, well, independent advisors in the public sector and in the private sector, they're pretty similar, but maybe the public sector is a bit more tricky in terms of there's more people involved in it. So I'll make some comments about the private sector, about LGPS. And I think the first point to realise is that you've got two very different constituencies that you're advising. One is the pensions committee, which is made up of counsellors who may not have very much financial experience at all, who are certainly not going to be the same level as the officers. And it varies a lot from fund to fund. But you've got to assume they're intelligent people, but are not financially people necessarily. They're as counsellors. And then you've got the officers who will consist of the pensions manager, and the finance director of the local authority and others, you know, who will have a lot of financial knowledge and be very bright, skillful and all that kind of stuff, and involved in this area and part of their normal job. So you've got to be able to speak to both of these groups at the same time. And that's got to be remembered. You can't favour one group in a sense. Some local authorities is very much officer-led, other ones are very much pension committee-led. So you're dealing with two different groups. And you're also actually dealing with the investment consultants and actuaries as well, who are part of the debate. If you go around the table, you're going to have these three different groups of people, all different levels of knowledge. And so part of the job is actually bringing them together and making sure everybody's speaking the same language and that you're making genuine progress and so forth. So that's quite a tricky part of the job. In the same sort of lines, I guess, part of the job is to explain to the pensions committee what they can reasonably expect their advisors to do, because often they don't realize that investment consultants could actually do X, Y, or Z for them. Or they don't realize that the actuary could do this or shouldn't be doing this, let's say. So that's an important point, to actually help them understand what their advisors can do. What else? Well, I mean, I guess what you cover, I think you asked that, well, you cover the top down, you cover economies and investment strategy and so forth. But you also spend quite a lot of time on managers and monitoring the managers they have, which now means monitoring the pools, investment pools, which I guess are 7 in the UK. And that's a different kind of thing. And that's probably not done as much as it should be. So that's quite a big part of the job. And there's other issues. The obvious one is ESG, climate change, which you get involved with in terms of dealing with that. And again, often that is just kind of trying to get people to be realistic about what they can genuinely achieve. I guess the last thing to say is that you've got to remember you're actually not a decision maker. You are just an advisor. And that's really, really important. You don't get too carried away. But you can be very heavily involved in the decision-making process. I mean, I am, for one of them, very, very heavily involved in how they make decisions, what decisions they make. But I am only an advisor. I must never forget.
We are now going to take a short break to speak with the sponsor of this series about what it is that makes them unique. I sat down with Tom Raber of Alvine Capital. So Alvine Capital has a unique business model that you call reverse inquiry. Can you tell us what reverse inquiry means?
When we were marketing or softly marketing funds, we realized that some institutional investors felt that they were being pushed and every call was the same as the one they just had. And we felt that we had to have another approach to institutional investors. And so we tried to really go behind the scenes and ask them, what exactly are you looking for? If you had a dream scenario and you had an opening in your fund, what would you like to have and how would that fund look? And when we got investors to open up and explain to us what they wanted, we then took down all the information we needed and we went out into the market. It's a pull sale rather than a push sale. You're actually helping the investor finding something that's better than they thought they were looking for in the first place.
In terms of your client base, so you work with a lot of Scandinavian and Northern European institutions. Is there anything on their mind today?
We opened an office in Stockholm last year. We have Nordic roots. We have obviously Nordic speaking people in London as well. We've covered the region for many years. Yes, we know it very well. What are they looking for? What's happening up in that part of the world is that they're a leader in anything that's ESG and impact. Some very large institutions have decided not to do anything at all unless it's completely impact, completely green. Everyone is looking for good, well-performing private equity and private credit funds. And we're fortunate that we're working with both in both categories. At the moment, we have a very good selection there.
And now, back to the show. And then just going back to the investment beliefs, because clearly bringing in this role as independent advisor, you are bringing decades of experience to the table. But equally, that experience has to evolve. So as you would say, look at your investment beliefs today and how they've evolved, where would you say you've turned your back on any asset classes, any approaches? Where would you say you look today and what opportunity set excites you?
Okay, there's kind of two different questions, I guess. One's how my skills evolved, and then secondly, where are we at today, right? I'm going to take it in two parts.
Sure.
So I guess you become less arrogant and less overconfident with time. I mean, you start off, you're supposed to go out there and meet the chief exec of BP or something when you're 27 and kind of criticize him for not doing the right job. I mean, that's kind of ludicrous, but you have to do that. So you become very confident, and so you become overconfident. And there's quite a number of occasions in my life when, you know, I let a guy, I never said the things I said. When one was, I was at a really high level investment get together with, you know, top guys. And I said, I'm sure Japanese yields are going to go to 4%. I'm really, really confident. And that was back in the 90s. And they haven't been anywhere near 4% yet. And that's a long time. So, you know, I'd never do that again. Confidence is one thing. And then being patient is the other one. That's a really difficult one. You've got to be patient. On the other hand, if you don't have triggers for something going right in your eyes, then, you know, it's going to take too long. No one's going to believe in what you're doing after 5 years of being wrong. And that's the other problem. So I guess that's how you kind of mellow a bit over time. You're less confident, and you've got to be confident, though. Don't get me wrong. Don't be decisive, but maybe not so brash or arrogant. And you become a bit more patient than you would be otherwise. In terms of themes today, or messages today, well, it's a really uncertain time. I mean, we've now got really big political issues on the go. Lots of uncertainty. We've got China, Taiwan. We seem to now have Japan, North Korea. We've got Russia and its all its aspects. Trump, US political extremism, there's all sorts of things there which are not normal parts of investment managers' jobs. I mean, they are, but not to the extent they probably are today. So in terms of advising a fund, I think you're going to say minimize your risk within reason. And you take advantage of opportunities that other people produce. There's going to be four sellers around as there are just now for real estate. Take advantage of these opportunities, but generally you don't stick your neck out too much. And I guess you probably want some punchy themes. Everybody seems to want punchy themes from asset allocators. So I have two for you. The first one is that the loss of confidence in central banks. And people were way overconfident in central banks. They ascribed abilities to central banks that they couldn't possibly have. Stop every market crashing, make sure inflation never happened, all these things. That's just rubbish, and people are realizing that's not possible anymore. And that's quite a lot of implications, particularly for bond markets. So I think bond yields will be in a different secular trend than they have been. And a lot of that's due to loss of confidence in central bankers. The other one, I guess, is that we've had a lot of politicians whose main aim has been to stay in power and nothing else. They haven't really had any beliefs. And I think you're going to have different politicians going forward. And they're going to have policies, social policies to a considerable extent. They're not going to have the number one aim of cutting corporate taxes. The ones that are going to come into power around the world are probably going to be much more socially orientated. And that can be very good for society, but may not be so great for investors. I think people have to be realistic and kind of just imagine what UK would be like under Labour government. It could be really good, but it's going to be different. And it's probably not going to be quite the same for investors or for companies. So they've got to really be realistic about it. What may well happen. And that applies elsewhere in the US and everywhere else.
It's interesting. When you talk about politicians, I think about timeframes. And it seems that a common trend in politics, both sides of the Atlantic, is ever shorter timeframes because there's a focus on the next election cycle, perhaps a more of a focus on getting re-elected and pandering perhaps to what's going to make a politician popular, and less of that kind of long-term timeframe that, say, the Chinese can take because they have their longer installments. That also seems to be an issue with investment news flow as well, that everything is getting disseminated in a shorter time frame. Do you think we have to be more nimble now, more agile, more willing to learn about new assets and new areas and more willing to adapt?
Yes, because change is happening faster. So yeah, you're going to have to cope with new ideas more quickly, but not nimble in a day by day or week by week or month by month type basis. Information and data is now very, very much more available than it's ever been in the past. So that's less valuable. So you really could have put a lot more emphasis in views and understanding and not just the raw data. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you knowing something nobody else knew was the kind of key. You could do it before they did it, but that's not the case. Everybody knows the basic things immediately. And so you're going to, it's how you interpret it, not just how many these numbers are on this site. I mean, if some number, because everybody in the world knows about it within 10 seconds, so you don't have any particular lead in time. And your inside information is not kind of what it was, as it were. that was kind of the be all and end all 40 years ago, 30 years ago, I believe. You're the only guy who knew this because you had lunch with somebody. That doesn't happen to the same extent anymore. Sure. So it's interpretation, having views, which have to change quite a lot. Probably a lot more than used to have to change, but it's not a week by week type thing.
Very interesting. So very consoling for those of us concerned about ChatGPT. If the value add of humans is that nuance, the interpretation, the opinion development, and not simply the data gathering, that would certainly bode well for our persistent value add, notwithstanding how this has evolved. What are the areas, because you asset allocation, I've always seen has been your core competency, and that covers all assets. Because sometimes people are siloed and maybe don't see, they're sort of maybe don't see the systems thinking approach, or they don't see maybe some issues that are overlooked. Would you say there's anything that investors are overlooking today in terms of not giving sufficient importance to a trend that could be very disruptive or something similar?
Well, I think the trends I've mentioned actually is the case. I don't think they are paying enough attention to a much more political government, which is less favorable to investors. But I think that is an example of that. Or not paying enough attention to central bank policy being different from what they thought it was. But apart from that, I think in some ways they're overappreciating things. I mean, I think private markets is an area where they're unduly enthusiastic just because they're called private markets. So some private markets are great. I personally am invested in private markets in agriculture and food, for example, which I think is a really exciting area. But the mainstream, just a regular private equity or maybe private debt markets, you know, have a huge amount of money trying to be invested in them. It's hard to believe everybody's going to get a good deal when the amount of money trying to find homes is a lot more than the kind of good investments available, in my view. So that's a kind of danger area, I would say. I mean, there's been a trend to invest as many different asset classes as possible for some time now. So it's hard to believe that there's a whole lot of asset classes out there that nobody's ever thought of or whatever. I mean, that was the case 10 years ago, 20 years ago, but people are very, very diversified across all sorts of things. That's been a way to make money for quite a long time for quite a lot of people launching funds. So as necessarily, as compared to the end investor. So I don't think there's a whole lot of totally unknown asset classes about to be developed next week.
What are the things you mentioned about the importance of nuance and interpretation? And obviously some people entering this industry are looking how to develop that sense or that ability to interpret, the ability to analyze. Where have you looked to gain some of this broader knowledge across the industries, and how do you assess what's on their mind today?
Yeah, well, you're doing analysis at two levels. One is kind of day-by-day type, what does the market think kind of analysis or investment? What's the psychology of the market? So maybe answer that one first. What's the psychology of the market? Well, I mean, I read a lot for a start. I think everybody does who's an investor. It's a big part of the job is reading. So you read the Financial Times, you read all the research from investment banks and boutiques and think tanks, you know, wide range of sources. I guess being experienced is helpful because you have a lot more contacts, a lot more people you can go to, and you can be more selective. So more ideas who's good and bad. And you talk to a lot of people. That's one of the really fun bits of investment management, is that you get to talk to really interesting people throughout your career from a whole range of backgrounds, academics or politicians or economists or CEOs of companies. Some of them are pretty controversial. So that's great fun, but that's also a really good source of what people are believing. But the markets themselves also tell you what the concerns are for participants. The extremes of the markets tell you that. So that's kind of the day-to-day type stuff. I mean, there's other more specialist kind of groups. There's a guy called Chris Darby runs a group for independent advisors, for example, which is really good for finding out what's thinking going on within the independent advisor community. And there's lots of similar groups for other different parts of the investment community. So it's really just reading a lot, talking to a lot of people. And if you want to do it in depth, then you do have to go and kind of have the knowledge to access the real experts. So, I mean, Bailey Gifford, for example, are very big in using academics to develop their research, which has worked very well for them. So in that case, we wouldn't normally have gone to in the past to find out what really is happening in the world.
And in terms of the industry itself, so a question I always ask here, and first of all, thank you for the plug for Chris Darby, and given we're in collaboration with them for this mini-series, so that's great. We're focusing on diversity, and the reason to bring together this series is to tap into some of that cognitive diversity that resides in the independent advisor universe. But diversity often has a different meaning within financial services. We think of gender diversity, diversity perhaps socioeconomic group by ethnicity. How have you assessed the development of the industry over the course of your career on this score?
Okay, well, I don't think I've had a particularly typical exposure to it. I think looked pretty good to me throughout my career just because of who I've happened to work for or the areas in which I've worked. So, you know, investment banking is totally different from investment management. Investment management's, I think, better than most other areas with financial services. Nature of the job, maybe. Its performance is very measurable. It's more intellectual, possibly, than some of the other areas. So I think that's helped quite a lot. Personally, I mean, the last three full-time jobs I had, top of the company was a woman, near the top of the company, all three jobs, so that made a big difference, I guess. And then a very global company, so there could be great diversity by background. If you have large international companies doing markets all over the world, it's not going to be a huge focus on any particular type of person, really, in terms of race or culture, so that's great. I mean, actually, going back to my thought about this before we had this chat, And my first little team of eight people, when I started off in life, there was two women and six men, which is not great, but that wasn't too bad back in 1980. And of the two women, one is now the chairman of Rolls-Royce, and the other one became global head of wealth management for Morgan Stanley. The one area where diversity hasn't worked at all is in terms of cognitive diversity. The herd instinct is as strong as ever.
Back to our discussion of game theory and incentives, it always comes back to human behavior. And just to touch on the independent advisor role, I'd say one of the, you said herd instinct, do you find that there is enough, perhaps even structural challenge set up in the governance regimes of institutional investors, whether that be a second consultant or deliberate stacking, perhaps, to have that kind of devil's advocate structure in a committee?
Well, independent advisors, devil's advocate's not really the right role for an independent advisor. They're not, that's too disruptive. They're supposed to bring things together and make things go calmly, not kind of do an Elon Musk at meetings. I think you'd be careful now. But yeah, they should be providing a challenge, particularly to the consultants and to the actuaries, who very rarely get challenged in my experience, and not just the managers. So yeah, definitely providing a challenge, but in a very constructive way. And I think they do. But obviously varies a lot by independent advisor. It depends what the independent advisor's background is. And they have a very different range of backgrounds. And, some are very focused in governance, and others are focused in this, and others are focused in that. So yeah, they should be challenging. They should be providing a different viewpoint, but not really devil's advocate. I think that's probably a bit strong.
Let's go back to your own career. As I said, it spans now a few decades. Any highs and lows in there, and in particular when it comes to the lows, any lessons learned, maybe through investment mistakes or setbacks?
Yeah, well, I mean, the lows are most obviously when you underperform. That's, if you're an investment manager, that's the bad times, right? And the good times are when you outperform. It's a pretty straightforward kind of job, really, in many ways. So in terms of the lows, what did you learn from that? You kind of keep going. I mean, the lows, career-wise, are kind of when you can't do what you want to do, in my experience, when you get frustrated, when the organization doesn't want to go as fast forward as you want to go, or people you're working with have different agendas. That's kind of very frustrating. That can last for years. So that's a kind of more structural low than just having a bad day when the markets go the wrong direction. So that's kind of where I would put the lows. But the highs, it's kind of obviously good performance, but you get satisfaction if you actually do something innovative. And I've been very lucky that I had an innovative career, partly because when I started off in investment management, it was a very, very basic industry. There's lots of scope to be innovative. The 1980s and 90s, I did systematic currency hedging, and I did factor analysis across the portfolio, not just a stock, which is now all commonplace, but back then it was unheard of. And that was just really exciting, doing that sort of thing. So that was hugely satisfying. I think I had the first ever secondary venture capital fund, which was tremendous. Do something no one else has ever done before and actually bring it into fruition. So these are, to me, the highs of my career, was doing something really different than nobody had done before. And that's a kind of structural thing rather than just having a fantastic year's performance.
But it's interesting because that is satisfying. Building something new is almost undervalued by individuals who look maybe at the paycheck at the end of that it is promised by a career. And I think it often gets to why so many individuals are dissatisfied in careers despite the paycheck, because it really isn't about the paycheck at a certain point. It is about the ability to build something, make a mark, make an impact. And I don't think it's just the millennial generation that wants to do that. Yeah. That's all to do with our purpose. So I think it is a very interesting observation. Just a couple of closing questions here. So were there any key people throughout your career that had an impact on you, and in what way?
Yeah, I think it's a very dangerous question to answer because I probably forget somebody who was really, really important to me and they'd be enormously offended. But choosing a few people, and there's lots and lots of other people. The first one, I guess, would be a guy called Jack Patterson back when I started off. And he just was a great innovator and did things nobody ever did before. And, it's hard to tell you just how basic the industry was back then. I mean, it was just unrecognizable from today's industry. I mean, credit rating didn't really exist. And I remember he invented some system for credit rating London boroughs. And it was the most basic thing you could ever imagine, but it was better than anybody else ever did at the time. And so he taught me just to be innovative and just go back to fundamentals and just find some way of doing things. And that was a big thing, was just find a way of doing it. Just think and just do that sort of thing. He invented asset classes. But he was just a tremendous influence and very much brought me into what he was doing. And the second guy is a guy called Barton Biggs, who you've probably heard of, who was Morgan Stanley's strategist. For some reason, he took me into his group of close buddies, I guess. And we used to go to the Bahamas every year, 30 of us initially, with all these big names. I won't name drop, but they were the biggest guys in fund management. And it was just like playing for Rafe Rovers, and suddenly I was playing for Chelsea. And it was just fantastic, you know, the guys. And I spent 5 days, 4 days each year with these guys. We just argued for 5 days. That's all we did. We sat on a table and just argued. And you just learned so much. And that was what really pushed me, I guess, from being a CIO to going to global strategy, because that was really, really interesting doing that sort of stuff. And that's probably the reason I did more strategy and less CIO. And the third person is Carol Galley at Mercury, who I'm sure you've heard of as well. And she was great for teaching me personal skills and for management training. Mercury gave a huge amount of management training to people. And that was really, really good, because you were trained about investments before. You weren't really trained all that well in fund management when I was younger in terms of how to manage people or manage this or manage that, or have the personal skills to do your job more effectively. And Mercury was tremendous for that. She was a really great personal coach. So three different angles, I guess. One's innovative, one's brought me to where I ended up, I guess, Bart, and the third was just making a better personal. And communication, she was great at teaching communication.
Those are a great list. And I should usually add the caveat that this is not supposed to be an exhaustive list, so that nobody takes offense from being left off it. Sure. It is just a couple of nuggets there. And then finally, any one piece of advice that you received from any of these, or a creed or motto that you developed on your own? And because I like to tie two questions in together, I'll do this again. And, you know, maybe you can end with any advice for your younger self.
Okay. So the one comment I tell people about, which I really remember, was one of my bosses said to me, "You're much brighter than I am, but I'm much richer than you are." And the point of saying that wasn't to be rude to me. It was to say that you can be far too clever for your own good. And I've always remembered that, you know, you may be the brightest person in the room. It doesn't mean to say you're the best person in the room, or you're going to be the best performer in the room. So I remember that really, really clearly. What else from that sense? I guess I just met so many high-powered people in my life, and just sort of try to learn as much as you can from them. If you meet a CEO of a company, just learn how they do their jobs and try and use some of their skills. And that applies to politicians, different people you meet. You are very lucky as a fund manager, because you meet lots and lots of high-powered, interesting people. So make the most of all these people you meet, becoming a better person yourself, as well as educating yourself. So that'd be advice to younger people. Other advice that I've benefited from would be focus on what really matters. And I've had bosses who would be incredibly powerful, have a whole range of interests, but something is really important, like a really, really big new business pitch, they wouldn't do anything apart from that new business pitch for 1 day or 2 days. And their ability to just focus on what really, really matters is important. Because people get involved in all sorts of things that don't really matter that much, which they could easily delegate to other people. So in your career, make sure you focus on what's really going to make a difference for you and for your company. And don't get involved in a whole lot of other hobby horses, which really don't matter very much at all. That's probably my words of advice.
Well, thank you so much, Colin. It's funny that the conversation didn't end up where I thought it would. I knew it was going to be a very technical and substantive discussion around asset allocation. I didn't expect it to delve so much into the human side of investing. And those five-day debates that you discussed, they just sound absolutely fantastic and the stuff that I would totally enjoy. And your focus on ideas, nuance, the importance of interpretation, and innovation, and ultimately your love of knowledge has really been very motivational here today. So thank you for coming here and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you very much, Ethan. I very much enjoyed our chat. Thank you.
I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to the 50 Faces podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring investors and their personal journeys, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.